Hello, I'm Badis, and welcome to the Implement Podcast. This is a podcast where we have great conversations about marketing, growing brands, and what it takes to be a great marketer. If you're interested in keeping up with the podcast episodes and the amazing content we produce at Implement, you should definitely subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to join-implement.com to subscribe. All right, enough self-promo, let's dive into this new episode, and thanks again for tuning in. Welcome to this new episode of the Implement Podcast. Today, my guest is Sylvie Giret. Sylvie is the Managing Director, North America of Debuyer USA. Sylvie, thank you so much for joining me today for this new episode. Could you maybe introduce yourself a bit more to the audience before we start?
Of course, but thank you, Badis, and the team for welcoming me and giving me a little bit of your time. Sure, so my name, like you said, is Sylvie Giret. Very French way. And I work for Debuyer, Debuyer, that's how Americans pronounce it. I joined Debuyer Debuyer earlier in January, like you said, heading the North American operations. And before that, I was actually here in the US. I've been in the US since 2007, so it's been a little while. I'm in New York. And before that, I was mostly working first as a banker when I arrived in the US. And then I had my own management consulting firm when I specialized in beauty, fragrance, and a little bit of fashion. So consumer good, definitely, pretty fast-paced US and Canada that I know pretty well after all these years. And on the personal note, so obviously I'm French. I've been in New York since 2007. Travel pretty much everywhere in the US since then. And I have two kids, an 18 years old that actually started at UCLA. So he's off to the West Coast, and the younger girl who's entering high school soon. So both very Americans.
Yeah, so it seems that this is what I actually, I was really excited to talk to you. Seems that you built this specialty of bringing in French brands and foreign brands into the US market. How did it start? Like, what was your first mission there, and how did it all start?
It started actually a while ago when I was still in Europe before joining, coming to the US. I was in London, and in London, I started getting really involved into this cross-cultural and transatlantic. Back then, it was not the Atlantic, but like those cross-cultural business relationships. And when I came to the US, I was heading the North American operations for the consulting division of the bank Natixis. We were advising those and managing the financials, mostly admin and financials for those the US subsidiaries of a lot of French companies. And I really got interested into understanding why so many French companies in particular have a wonderful, wonderful expertise and great products, and very few actually managed to make it. So when I left Natixis, I decided, you know, immigration, I mean, everything that makes the charm of the US at some point, that you have to make it happen by yourself. You have to count on yourself only. So this I've done. So I created actually my own firm, where I became, you know, an advisor and also became very operational, trying to help support, operate French brands that I felt were underperforming in the US market. And trust me, it's been a learning process. I don't pretend to give lessons to anybody, but this is something that I got gradually specialized into. And what fascinates me is number one, that we have such great products in France in general, and I know consumer good products, but we lack, if I may put it this way, we lack a sense of how this American consumer works. It's something that we don't understand as French people coming from France. And I modestly pretend that I know a little now after 14 years of doing it every day.
So what are the French brands missing about the US consumer? Like, what are they not understanding?
So it's not that they don't understand, because I don't want to be, obnoxious. It's that they underestimate the level of competition, the pressure. They have a very, they're very proud of what they're doing, which is absolutely cool, and it's great. They have to stay proud of what they're doing. But unlike, unlike an American brand maker, American brands makers are going to be trying to make a product, obviously serving a purpose, but they're going to be from scratch, very much business oriented. They create a product to fill a gap. They create a product according to the consumer needs. French are going to more, if I can stereotype a little bit, be tempted to create products for the sake of creating a product that they believe is going to change the world. And they very much usually underestimate the ability of the consumer to understand. Sometimes it's way too sophisticated. You don't create a need in the US market. You fill in blanks. And that's the biggest, if I make it, I hope it's clear, the biggest difference in terms in our cultures. Here in America, you have to think about the problem you're solving, and the problem has to be existing. Otherwise, forget it. It's never going to work. And plus, you know, like I said, tremendous pressure. The made in France, the French touch is still very interesting and important, but to a certain degree. Not anymore as the number one criteria of decision. So altogether, this is why a lot of French, especially startups, especially in the world that I know really well, which is the cosmetics division category industry, think is that they under very much underestimate where the bar is. And sometimes not a question of having the bar too high, it's having the bar all over the place.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say to answer your so long answer to a short question.
No, it's a brilliant answer. Thank you for it. It's really interesting because maybe I feel like it's because the French operate in a market where it's kind of a small market, and you know it's just a different of size. So for sure, when you're arriving in a much larger market and you kind of have three, maybe four times the number of competitors you're used to, you have to rethink your whole strategy. And that's how I would analyze it. So maybe there's another cause, but I think it's really because France is a small market.
So you're right. This definitely plays plays a role, I would say. I would go back to the culture. Regardless of the size, it's really a question of the culture of the consumer. In France, the consumer is very much more involved and interested in understanding products. So don't take me wrong, French is a complicated market. I know plenty of people right now that I'm not going to name who struggle to get into pharmacies. But see, we have pharmacies, for instance, that play a role in explaining products and still. Anyway, I would say the consumer is using their brain, if I may. I'm not pretending that the Americans don't use their brain, but the Americans are way more in the temptation mode and the promises. French are going to be very skeptical about promises that are way too generous. Like, I'm going to make you feel 10 years younger. Like, really? No, as a French, you're going to be like, nah, I know it doesn't exist. So you're going to look into it. So in France, when you talk to the French consumer, you have to be way more pragmatic, but also way more substantiated. Mm-hmm. In the US, if you launch a product saying, so I'm going to make you look 10 years younger, pending that you have done all the FDA and stuff, and all, I'm stereotyping a little bit, people are going to believe you like, oh, my God, they're going to make me 10 years younger. And if you know how to tell a story, they're gonna grab it and they're gonna adopt it. So it's a little bit stereotype, but that's my best example of how the two sides of the Atlantic work. So to my point, for brands that are taking a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of passion to create products, they have a much better reception in France that they're going to have here, because here it's like a attention span of the consumer is less than 3 seconds. So if you don't catch the attention with something really strong in 10 seconds, in the 3-5 seconds, you're done.
It seems that you know, we could call this like utilitarianism, meaning like the American consumer is maybe more interested in the utility of the product, in the sense that, you know, they're, as you said, they're buying a solution to a problem, and they don't really care about whatever, you know, you can put around it, and they don't really have time to understand your product, and maybe they won't spend as much time. So is that how you would this is how I understood it. So it's really
To your point, time is money for Americans. Time is money. So the time they're going to give you as a brand has to be valuable. So in this industry where I'm now, which is cookware, which is slightly different than cosmetics, which is like super over competitive and hard actually to differentiate. So cookware is more, if you look at the consumer, it's more like passionate people, especially that type of cookware that the Bouillet is making. So they are, it's something that they are interested in. So they're going to be very much more leaning on taking the time to, you know, learn about your product, learn about how they can benefit from buying your product, but you cannot lie to them. They're going to be very, you know, Debuyer is a good example because in France, they've been around since 1830. So everyone knows Debuyer, and it's the name that belongs to the country. Here in the US, Debuyer, they don't even know how to pronounce it. They're like Debuyer. So you have to develop your edge. You have to develop your specific features. People, they're going to be like, huh, this is something I've never heard of. That's the key. You have to give your customer, your client, something they never heard of. So it's harder and harder because, you know, it's differentiating at any cost becomes complicated. Mm-hmm. But it's a promise that it's going to improve their life. So in beauty, you're selling them something that's going to improve their look, or maybe that's why makeup works so well in the US, because it's an instant. Like if you use my foundation that I'm trying to sell you, you're going to look so much better in an instant. That's an argument that they buy because they love it. In cookware, it's a little bit different. You're going to make them understand and come to it. You cannot convince a customer from a being too aggressive. They have to make it theirs. You're going to suggest gradually, and you have to be at the level of your promises that it's going to improve their time in the kitchen. It's going to improve the flavor of what they're cooking. It's going to improve this and this and that. So this is how you build. You have, number one, to catch the consumer attention with something that they can understand. So sometimes we French make it too complicated and they're like, wait, what? And they pass because they just don't get it. So make it understandable, meaning you have to study the customer first and adapt your approach and your marketing argument and all to what the customer is expecting, and not the other way around that we French tend to do too much. And from there, you talk to the consumer about the benefits. Stop talking about your product. Product is just a reassuring thing that you have to talk about. Okay, it has to be solid, has to be of good quality, non-toxic, da, da, da. Those are attributes. Talk to the consumer about benefits. The French tend to talk to the consumer about themselves and their product. It's too much. It's just a disconnect.
Yeah, that's, thanks for sharing this. I think it's not easy to do this. I mean, especially when you're used to a specific type of messaging, when you already have your assets built up, your marketing, you've figured it out in France, and then you have to kind of throw it out the window and start over. It's not easy. So this is how you're helping these brands kind of transition. In this transition, I want to talk a little bit about sort of the tactics and the operational side of things. How do you launch a brand that is well known in France or, you know, in Europe, and make it start over there? Like, how do you start? What's sort of the different channels, the different timeline? Are we looking into sort of a 1 or 2 year build up until we sort of invest a bit more, like what kind of operational resources you need in place in the US to make it work? You see what I mean? Like, what's on the operational side? How does it work?
This is a very good question, and I'm going to try to be concise, otherwise I'm going to be busy for the next 2 weeks talking about it. So in a nutshell, I would say that you have to start by knowing your customer. I'm obsessed with customers because that's more and more the most important point. So start, take the time. This market is here, has been here for a long time. They're going to still be here in 2 years from now. So no rush. Too many companies think that signing a partnership with a retailer is going to do the job. So not only it doesn't do the job, but second, two things actually that I'm gonna say about that. Retailers, they need to know that your brand is already on demand. So we go back to you having to create your own traction. And number two, if you give the keys of the house to partners like that, you have no idea, actually. You still don't learn. You don't learn what's going on, who your customer, you have an idea because the type of retail, but you still don't give yourself a chance to really understand who your target consumer is. So my advice, and even with WBA, WBA is very well installed in the US, doing really well, having both distribution in place and direct to consumer. We learn everything from the direct to consumer, and we apply it. And we, if I may use this word, we use the wholesale, the retail distribution to get to where we want to be and not the other way around. And that's my advice to even more brands launching, which is a little scary at first because they're like, oh my God, I'm in France. I don't have the money. How am I going to do it? So it's not so much a question of having a ton of money yet. It's a question of being able to be consistent, to be willing to do the job and to sweat it a little bit. This market is super over duper complicated. It's not me saying, so I cannot make it easier than it is. Only brands that are ready to work consistently, it's a try and error thing as well. Some stuff that I recommend that I do myself, some work, some don't work. The idea is to be able to adjust permanently, but that means that for the first, I would say, I'm going to try to tell you, I would say 12 to 24 months. It's a learning curve. It's a learning process. You get to learn. So you need to have a tactic in place. You need to know what your strategy and your ideal distribution, for instance, should be 2 years from now. Yeah. And you work backwards. If you say my dream as a cookware company and brand is to be with Saks and people like Saks because I'm super high-end, I love Saks, I've always my dream to be at Saks. Okay, number one, it has to make sense. If it makes sense, you're going to build your strategy to be appealing to Saks, and you have to give yourself the time. Saks, whoever, they're going to look at how many, for instance, followers you have on Instagram, and they're going to look at your, of course, the profile of the brand. So, for instance, something that we always advise to do is to create your own, the local Instagram. They're going to look at the UGC, the user generated content. If you have like external content, you're going to look and evaluate the traction on the brand, because once they welcome you in their assortment, they need to know that it's going to sell, and they're not going to do the job for you. You have to make sure that your brand is on demand. So it's a strategy that you build. So the first 6 months, I advise to be looking at consumer focus groups, stuff like that. There's a kind of a program that I usually implement. And from there, you build your go-to-market strategy, which is for the next 12 to 18 months. There's trade shows. You have to be at the right trade shows. You don't start with a trade show. Or you can start with a trade show if it's just to explore. But don't expect retailers, whatever you've been sold by the organizers, don't expect retailers to pick you at the trade show. It's not happening. So nothing's happening yet. You have to build in sequence, and you have to be ready to try and make mistakes. Money-wise, you don't need to, I'm so sorry, but this is it's an investment that you need to be able to make on the long run, but not necessarily a lot of money right away. Don't go after like magic wands that seem like very appealing right away. Nothing works on this market. Otherwise, we will all be millionaires. So we would know. The only thing that works is consistency, being as close as possible of your target market, understanding, listening to people who are here. You're not any different from anybody else. So those who know, those that are here have mistakes and have had also successes. And sweat it.
This is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing this. I just want to recap because there was like so much information. Just want to make sure I understood and I took a lot of notes. But basically what you're saying is that first of all, you need to build a direct relationship with your consumer, whether in some social media or with direct sales, and you need basically data on your consumer. So spending like the first part of your implementation strategy doing that. Yeah. And afterwards, only afterwards, you will have the ear of potential retailers, whether it's at trade shows or like with direct outreach, I guess, that are going to distribute your product afterwards. But and finally, what you're saying is that it's a really long-term game. Like it's not something that you can just come in and even if you're successful in France, you will probably not be from the get-go in the US. Is that what you're overall?
That's a perfect summary. Exactly. Right. The three points that I have to keep in mind. Yes.
Yeah. And I feel like it's... it's not as complicated for a US brand to set up in France. I mean, it depends, obviously it depends on the industry and it depends on a lot of different things, but as you said, it's a whole new business. So taking 2 years to set it up is absolutely necessary. And in terms of like teams and do you need someone there or today with all the technology we have?
No, you need to have ears and knowledge of the field. So that's always the tricky question, what type of person you should get. So this is a very broad subject. That's why usually, you know, the Germans are going to go with somebody who's German. The French are going to go with somebody who's French. As long as this person... You can very much go with Americans. Problem with Americans is that they wanted to succeed right away. Americans are instant. It has to get big fast because for a lot of reasons I'm not gonna detail here because it would take too long. So sometimes the mistake that French companies make is by hiring an American, they're putting the money down, but it doesn't last because it takes too long to generate results. American also about status. They need to be able when they get to they go to their friends to say, "Oh, I work for this WA company." If everybody says who, nobody heard about them. That's for them a problem. So the excitement, if you will, of working for an unknown company, developing it's going to last a little while. But after a while, they need to be able to tell a name that's like tells something to people. That's why LVMH, L'Oreal, all these big groups are so successful in hiring and firing as well, by the way, because everybody knows them and they're fascinated. Mm. So in terms of sizing, you have to, well, number one here, this market is very, very flexible. And like France, you can, when you say hire, you never really hire anybody. You just, you know, take the services of somebody, can make contracts, you can hire it's an at will situation. So there's not as much constraint and in France. And when they come from France, people tend to be scared of having those teams that are very remote. I don't. I have a ton of freelancers that are doing a great job that I've been working with for like 10 years. They're part of my team in a way, but they're not employees. So that tends to scare the French a little bit because they feel there's not going to be any commitment. Mm. Oh yeah, there is. It's just a different culture of work. At WE, it's a little different because we also have a team, a proper team, a permanent team, which is great. And we have, I'm progressively adding, freelancers that I know because freelancers are going to come with they have high skills. They're very highly skilled in something that you might not need full time. So the ability of people like me, and I'm very much not the only one, or building the skill set. It's a skill set. It's like a series of tools. You need a certain amount of tools that are actually very technical to succeed. So, and sometimes French think that you can find them in like a sort of Swiss knife situation where you're going to find the right person doing it all. Never. So team-wise, it's a very get for the skills. Don't be afraid of paying people. Sometimes I have discussions that I don't understand those discussions when I say this guy costs 155 an hour. Oh my God, it's too much. Too much because of what? It's 155 an hour, depending. Of course, if you, I mean, it's all a question of reference, and it's a question of paying the right amount of money and having budgets in place. You need to have a budget. Of course, you're not going to welcome anybody saying who's 300, 500. But for certain skills, you have to be ready to pay the price. What never works in this market is when you try, if the right person is 150 and you try to go for like 50, sooner or later, rather sooner than later, you're going to pay the price and it's going to be hurting.
Yeah. So currently what you're saying is that you are working with freelancers, but these freelancers are they like reps? Are they sales reps? Or are they, do they work on other parts?
I'm going to talk about my current experience and the past experiences. So we have reps. Definitely, we do have reps. But again, don't expect any magic from reps unless you provide the support. Any rep, it's a resource at your disposal, but they're not going to do the job for you. I mean, of course, they're on the field. You're not. They're here to identify new accounts and generate new business. But again, put yourself in the shoes of a rep. They're paying on commissions only. So they have to pay the same bills as you and I. They have to make money. So on a portfolio of like, I don't know, 5 brands, if yours is not supported, nobody knows about it, too complicated to sell, don't expect any magic. They're going to focus on the brands that they know that their retailers are going to buy right away, saying this one, no, because I never heard, I'm going to think about it. But this one, yes, I need them because the retailer knows that customers are going to walk in and ask for the product. So again, to your point, yes, we have reps, but it's hard work to get reps to be successful for your company and for themselves. And I don't blame them because it's horribly difficult to be just like living on just commissions. Otherwise, I like to have freelancers for like everything graphic design related because it's, we like to have like super creative people, but we cannot come, my brands and even WE were too small to afford a full time. So we, this is typically the type of skills that we go after. Social media, I really recommend to keep it internal. So if you're in a setup where don't have a subsidiary here and you're hiring like freelancers, make sure that it's not someone who's too young and too inexperienced. You really have to make sure that this person understands your brand. It's important. But otherwise, everything that's marketing related, content writing, development, we're on Shopify. God knows how many developments we need to make every other day to make sure that we have exactly what we want. Those are freelancers very easy to hire. You have like platforms like Upwork that work really well that I use all the time, project based. So a lot of freelancers, sales is slightly different. Sales, you want to have people who are committed to your brand. So reps for sure, but reps that take the time to understand your brand. Graphic design, you can hire somebody on the fly and hopefully it's a good person, but you can change a graphic designer.
Yeah.
Reps, you don't change every other day.
Yeah, it brings me to a question I'm just curious about right now, which is the sort of the geographic coverage, because I'm putting myself into the shoes of a, let's say, a small like French brand. When I say small, like maybe they do an 8-figure revenue, but they're not like super, super big. I'm wondering, like, should I launch in a specific part of the country first, because it's such a large country? I can't cover like from New York to LA, right? I need to sort of focus. Or is it still an issue, or nowadays with tech, you don't have to worry about that?
I never understood this geographic approach, because again, if you approach it from a consumer perspective, your consumer is everywhere. So if you decide to put together a digital strategy first, you don't need to worry about the location. Your consumer you have to understand the profile of a consumer. Is it a woman? Is it a guy? Do they have, like, you have to profile your consumers. But the US is made a certain way where there's no rule. So if you're looking for a consumer who have money, for instance, like the highest end of the, because your products are super premium, the mistake is to think that these people are in New York or LA. God, if you go to Texas, it's Texas, New Mexico. I think when I was representing luxury fragrance, I think this is where we're making the most sales, is in those southern states where you have this super wealthy community of people who are very usually pretty highly educated. They travel, so they value stuff that maybe in other side of countries you're not going to get, but they're very much receiving, and they have the money, and they don't have so much offer. So they're going to be very much more willing to spend the money because you're going to be standing out. Mm. New York is a horribly difficult market, and New York is a melting pot. It's very hard to read New York. Mm. Yes, it's expensive to live in New York, meaning that you would think that, you know, a lot of people living here have the money. No, if you look at New York itself, New York City and Manhattan in particular, it's super, super diverse. So it's very hard to approach, and I'd never recommend to approach, especially from a digital marketing standpoint, the country with the geography, because it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Understand your customer, and when you get to the phase where you find you choose, where you start kicking in your retail strategy, your distribution strategy, this is where you look at geography, because chains or you need to go where your product's going to be well received. But that's because you have the data. You know that historically, even if the history is only 18 months or something, your product responds well in LA metro area or the West Coast in general, more than the Midwest. And you can also give it a try, saying, hey, Midwest, I don't know why, never really worked, but we're going to give it a try with some retailers, because some population are they're very different and very diverse, but you have like common points, common features. So you can start looking at geography when you approach your retail strategy, but again, down the road, not immediately, because otherwise you're going to give yourself the wrong reading of the market. This is true for Americans going to Europe, because countries are different. France is not the UK, which UK is not anymore in Europe. So France is not Germany, which is not, I don't know, Holland. So of course they're forced to make those steps. In the US, you don't have to, because it's one country, but it's horribly difficult to approach it from a geographic standpoint.
Yeah. So what you're saying is, focus on a segment of consumers rather than geography, which doesn't make sense in the, all right, totally fair. Yeah, totally understand it. And obviously, when you're in a, especially now with the e-commerce and even more now with the e-commerce and DTC approaches, it makes even less sense. Absolutely.
And look at your data. Look at your data and understand. And the consumer in the US, they move a lot. So, but you still have but you get to that point after a certain amount of one month of data that you're reporting and analyzing. And you're like, usually I have this, happening after like 12 months, like they have a totally different reading of the country than they had when they approached it in the first place.
Yeah. Thank you. It's really interesting. I think it's, there's probably another barrier we don't talk about enough, which is the language barrier, because like French executives that are good, that speak English, you can find a lot of them, but that are really comfortable dealing with a lot of American stakeholders and kind of understanding the you know, the language, the idioms, the like all the small things, the small cultural things, it's hard to find. It's hard to come by. So you need to partner. You need to partner with local people at some point. And
Yeah, but I would say that the French companies cannot, you know, pass on that. I still see too many, even the young generation, where they don't speak good English. And that makes a whole difference. Because like you said, there's the language, everybody's sort of, not everybody, that's the point. Like it might be sort of easy and common to understand English, but you have to be able to express yourself. And it's very rare. I've worked with a lot of French small, mid-sized companies, and they are not comfortable in English. They're not even less comfortable in the culture. The American who tells you, "Oh my God, Sylvie, this is great." The French translation means, "I don't give. I'm going to be stay polite. I don't care. This is great. May have no meaning unless you know the person." And da, 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 da. And French tend to read that first level. At WEA, I think we in the US market, we're very, very lucky because our top management in France, they speak perfect English, and they speak, I would say, the business English, because they've all worked for like more or less big companies, not so much the companies they work with, but they worked, our CEO has worked and lived in Canada, in Australia. He understands, he's been in those big American companies, and the moment he walks in a room, works with COVID, doesn't work in a room these days, but in a Zoom call with American decision makers, he speaks the same language. Same with our international director, he lives in China. So they know about this, and it makes a whole difference at the company level. Yeah. And I still see, and I'm super worried about the young generation when I see that they don't speak English. And I'm like, guys, this is now, this has happened. You have to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely. And I think it really helps to, if you don't have it, to sort of gain that experience of the country. I mean, it's valid for implementing your brand in the US, but in any country, you need to spend the time there. You need to learn about the culture. You need to, it really does help a lot. And you can just do it from just your computer back in your home country, for sure. You know, to sort of wrap up the episode, because time flies and we're almost done with the timing. What are the big challenges for WEA? Like, what are you working on, and what's coming?
The brand actually got COVID, and the pandemic actually really helped all the category, and helped WEA booming last year. So it was a blessing, and it created a change, a shift in the business model of the brand. So it was like a lot of consumers suddenly paying more attention to willing to cook, willing to bake, and paying more attention to high quality products. So it was really a blessing, I'm sorry to put it this way, from a business perspective for the WEA in particular, and very much the category. Now the challenge that we have is to, so we're a little backwards, but that's for good reasons. It's to build the brand, to make sure that it's not just a question of, there was a pandemic and people cooked more. And when the pandemic is over, because this is where we're heading to in the US, we're getting more normal now, that people forget and, you know, move away from the brand. So now our challenge is really to create the traction on the brand, the brand awareness, and to make people go beyond the one or two hero products that they know at the WEA. So it's really about building. It's wonderful actually to work for such an old company established since 1830 that is also in a way super young here in the US. It's very challenging. We have to build pretty much everything, but we are, it's in a very positive and productive environment, because we're selling a lot of, I mean, our products are very very well received. So we are in a very good dynamic. So like I said, brand awareness, creating traction at the brand level, making WEA with the pronunciation also challenge the buyer, become a reference like we have, for instance, Le Creuset. Creuset has become a reference. People don't exactly know why sometimes they buy it in this category, but they have to have a Le Creuset. It's like having a Vuitton as a bag. So that's our challenge, and that's our objective. We're ambitious, and we know that we can make it. And of course, I could keep speaking for like 2,000, another 2 hours about what we're doing to get there. But that's the plan for 2021 and 2022.
Sounds really exciting. I think if Le Creuset made it, you can definitely do it as well, guys. So good luck with that. Do you have somewhere where people can find you online if they have any questions or if they want to follow up on the episode?
They can totally reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn and my name is Sylvie Giret. Sylvie Giret, G-I-R-E-T. Reach out to me through LinkedIn. That's the best way to do so. I'm not really good at Instagram. I'm using Instagram for work mostly, so not a big social media. I'm a little too old maybe for that. I don't know. So LinkedIn is definitely the best way to reach out to me, and I'll be happy, for instance, in the limitation of my time to, provide like a couple of advice modestly if I can be of any use to people.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time again. Thank you.
Thank you, Baddies. Thank you for the opportunity. And I hope that, it's going to be useful and, click for some people on, I'm going to revisit my US strategy.
Yeah,
happy to be here.
Sure it will. Thank you.